we studied 1,600 deals, the actual opportunity data across about a year and a half worth of a sales organization data. And no surprise, what we found in that is buying team complexity rose, like functional number of people involved, executive involvement, win rates dropped. No surprise there. But we also created a way to measure the extent to which a salesperson has this executive officer mentality. And it's not surprisingly, they're also able to mitigate and reverse that buying team complexity. They win far more often than those that don't have high levels of that executive officer mentality. So if we know if we can improve that, that your sales teams will win more.
First, welcome to the Revenue Insights podcast, a CRO Insights podcast brought to you by the Revenue Alliance. This podcast is for revenue leaders, chief revenue officers who are looking for insights from experts in the field. My name is Warren Zenna. I'm the founder of the CRO Collective and appreciate the partnership I have with the Revenue Alliance and ongoing content development. And today I'm really excited. I have a very smart person, Curtis Schroeder from Verisint, whom, you know, is an academic, a PhD, and now is involved in commercial operations. I'd be really fascinated, Curtis. Thanks for being here.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. Yeah. Just excited to be a part of it.
Yeah. So I'd love to hear, if you don't mind, like, how do you make this journey from an academia into what you're doing? I'd love to understand, like, how that happened and, you know, like, what's the, I see a lot of academics in the space and I wonder what that looks like. Most people come from, they're salespeople, you know, or they're engineers and stuff. So if you don't mind, a little background on that and kind of what you're doing at Verisint right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, thanks for the opportunity to be on. Really excited to speak to this group because it's at the heart of the kinds of organizations, the kind of leaders that I enjoy working with. And I feel like research has a really important place for in today's world. And so when I think about my background, I'm not somebody who started in the academic world and then just moved into business. I feel like I've always served and had this mindset that's a bridge between the world of academia and the world of industry. I got exposed to the world of academic research pretty early on in my career through the business-to-business sales areas. I spent a decade at Oracle and Gartner and now work at Verisint, which I'll talk about more in a second. But my career started at Baylor University in the Center for Professional Selling. So there's actually, you know, universities across the country that have dedicated sales researchers that are doing really important work for sales leaders and for salespeople and for sales and revenue operations groups. But what I found pretty early on was a lot of that research is done a bit in isolation and in a vacuum. And what I'm sure, as we'll talk about today, everything comes back to incentives. And that's really how the incentive structure and the way that academic is set up, there's not always this great partnership with the application of that research for industry and really the engagement of industry to really inform what kind of research should be done. So in many cases, and there's some great exceptions to this rule, but in many cases, there's this gap between the academic world and the industry world. And I just, as I kind of got interested in this space in particular, I imagine you've seen this too, is that salespeople, sales leaders are hungry for those ideas and those strategies that are going to give them an edge. And so I always was really engaged in the idea of how can I use the curiosity that I have about how things work and why things work and the deep desire to help people grow and develop with that kind of evidence-based approach to work itself, that it just always has been naturally part of my approach to work, to think about where is there evidence, where is there research that can be done that can be really practical and applied in the sales world. And so you mentioned it. I started my career at Baylor. I got a PhD at Oklahoma State University in sales research. I'm currently doing postdoctoral research right now at Texas A&M, but I'm also working full-time at Verisint, and I lead our research and insight function here. So let me stop there. That's a lot of information, but kind of at least a little bit of bridge of how I think.
Great. A lot of stuff I want to ask about that. Because, you know, this is just interesting because I'm fascinated by certainly there's incredible brain power in these institutions and a lot of really smart people and methodologies and all that. But there's also just, if I may, just the perception of like, just doing it is enough. Like, just do it, sell, you know, you learn a lot, you know, and that's all I did my whole life was just sell, you know? So you get someone who's in the weeds for 20 years, you know, you sit them down, you ask them questions and, you know, who's to say, I'm curious to know your thoughts on this. Who's to say that like someone who sold for their entire career and successfully, and then someone who researched it for their entire career, who you think would have more insights about it?
It's a great, I maybe it's counterintuitive or perhaps minimizing to some extent the great work in the academic space. But I always think that the great ideas, the great practical application of that ideas, you can't beat a career of somebody who's done it, who's sat in seat, who's carried the weight, the pressure, the responsibility of carrying a bag, who's had to work in a complex internal organization, how to get access to resources and people and learn the latest about their products and their industries and their customers, having to navigate the complexity of their customers' buying organization. Like you're just not going to beat a 20-year career from somebody who's been in that. Now, what I'll say is that the learnings from that 20-year career are oftentimes supported in great research that kind of proves the things that are obvious. Yeah, do incentives work? Absolutely. And here's the kind of instances where they work. Or you know, should companies leverage technology in particular ways to get better pickup? There's some obvious things that come out of that. But I also think that the speed that the industry is evolving, especially in the last 3 to 5 years, there's a lot of new things that are coming out that we can't just rely on our gut, our instinct, and our history to know how to best move forward. And so I think it's really where you can combine the experience and the practical nature of somebody's background with how can we understand things in a more rigorous, conceptual way with research and kind of find the happy balance between those. Now, the one thing I'll also say is that the academic world of research moves fairly slow. And that's by design in many ways, in the sense that there's a level of rigor that's required to say that we empirically understand how these things work, that there is great evidence that shows that X influences Y, right? And these kinds of things. But that speed of academic research doesn't always move at the speed of business. So even in that tension between, is it better to have sat in a research role and understand the world conceptually from an academic perspective, or is it better have sat in the seat of a 20-year professional? There are places between those two where I think we can learn from one another. And that's really what I've built my career around, is how do we find those that common ground and get the most out of both of those?
It makes sense. I mean, academia as an institution with its, you know, decades and decades and decades of being, there's methodologies that those institutions deploy to understand how to look at things and analyze things and extrapolate things. And that becomes a valuable system of thinking, which I guess is supposed to be applied to anything. I mean, you could apply it to geology and weather and, you know, economics. I get it. So I what I'd like to know more is, it's a lot of this is really interesting to me. So you why did you choose this as a place to study? Like, why didn't you just go sell? Like, I'm interested in like where that nuance comes from, because, you know, I was interested in selling too. So I went and I sold shit, you know. I didn't go to college to learn how to study selling. It was just, it's just an interesting sort of choice. I'm curious to know like where the differentiator is, if I may. Be more succinct. Like, how would you define the difference between, because you made a good point, which I think everyone would agree that someone who comes out of a program like yours is certainly going to be pretty damn smart about things. However, if I were to somehow make a very concrete distinction between sales experience and academic sales research experience, what is the difference? Where's the additive that a academic perspective brings to an already existing empirical sales modality? What is it, and how do you know it?
Well, so it's a great question, and I think let me answer two parts of what you talked about. How, why did I choose this area? Why did I just get the bag and start selling?
Appreciate it.
but also the second part about the connectivity between those. Yeah. And so the first part I'll say is that if I go back even further into the psychology of Curtis Schroeder, the longest time I was involved with music, and I always thought that my career would be as an orchestral or a choral conductor. Okay. I always had this idea. Was I ever the best individual singer or the best individual instrumentalist? No. But I had this ability to kind of sit beyond it, to recognize what good looks like, and to orchestrate in many ways the connectivity between all of those different areas, right? And so when I think about my background and my interest in that, the ability to sit in a research role or to look at research is to kind of take a step back from being the individual and to look at the collective group together to see what can we learn and how does this piece work with that. And so, again, this is not to minimize any individual or even minimize 20 years of experience. But if you think about somebody who sat in a financial services sales leadership role and has spent 25 years in financial services, they know that industry inside and out. They know the kinds of customers, they know the products, they know the nuances of that environment. Does all of that experience really translate into high tech? Does it translate into comms? Does it translate into all the different kinds of evolving roles? Did it help you with how to evolve into hybrid selling and digital selling and video selling? Now, there are certainly principles that apply across those, right? But I think that's where I see the opportunity to step back from the individual expertise and being the first chair soloist violinist. You can kind of look at the patterns across a lot of broader of the industries and look for evidence that helps us see how those things fit together and work together more holistic. Where do you look for the generalizations, the things that are good for all or for more? And so my role and what I've always enjoyed doing was seeing how can I certainly want to be as good at anything individually as I can, but how can I use my skills and the things I'm uniquely gifted at, I think, to help influence, be a force multiplier in many ways, create an outsized impact for other people. And so sometimes, you know, maybe you're a big reader or maybe you like watching the news, whatever it is, wherever we go for information, we're bringing those ideas back with us. And so I'd rather those ideas not be always influenced just by intuition and gut and experience, but to find some data and some evidence to help us move forward in a productive way.
Yeah, makes sense. So if you don't mind, I love an example. Like, let's say I want to look at it this way. So because you're working for these kind of organizations, so you're doing this, you probably could be really good at giving me this example. So I'm a sales organization, rather large one, and I've got a bunch of salespeople. We've working out the normal way sales organizations do is they try things, they get to product market fit, they build their product, and they get to a point where they're seeing some degree of predictability. And then they're introduced to the idea of bringing in someone who researches sales or does the sort of thing that you do. What would be an example of the kind of thing that you brought to an organization that was additive that they would not have gotten had they not spoken to you?
Let me answer that on two sides too. So when I think about what I do for Verisint in my role here as a member of a research function at a software company, which is a little bit of a unique role. Not many companies I feel like have this kind of role, but there are more than more that are coming out. When you think about how even marketing is evolving and brand development of an organization is evolving, we can't rely on search engine optimization anymore. We can't rely on just putting out a bunch of content because ChatGPT and large language models have allowed us to just flood the market with information. So now we have this over rotation towards content and ideas that just, how do we know what's important? I've always said the two things that you can't replicate with ChatGPT are experiences and primary data. And so to me, that's what stands out. That's what allows an organization like Verisint the opportunity to speak to revenue leaders in a different way. Like my job, and maybe I'll say this at the detriment of our sales team, but I always kind of say this tongue in cheek, is like, I'm not here to sell software. That is not my job for Verisint. Yep. I mean, I support it. I want our teams to do really well. And I believe we've got great products at Verisint. But I don't go in having conversations about technology. And that's by design. I spend my time trying to uncover the big ideas, the strategies, the sales behaviors that drive go-to-market success. And so that we can arm revenue leaders with more meaningful ideas, with original research and insights, they actually take those ideas or takes questions back to their boardrooms and go, why aren't we thinking about this? Or what are the things that we should be thinking about? Or we've got X amount of dollars to prioritize where we focus our funds. Where are we going to get the greatest return from our investment? Where are we going to make our bets? And so it's really being involved in those conversations. And certainly there's a place for software and technology to solve for some of those problems, whether it's Barisint or otherwise. But it's about how do we connect research and the revenue operating functions and help organizations design smarter and more human revenue systems inside our own organization. So that's the side of it where I'll say from a Verisint perspective, it's really about how do we use research and data, which can't be replicated, which I think sales leaders are hungry for ideas and hungry for things that actually support their intuition, because not everybody believes intuition anymore. We're constantly in a conflict of our own opinions. So where can we use something that's a little bit more grounded to either reinforce something that we feel or know or want to do, or maybe even cause us to rethink something that we've always assumed. So that's the Verisint side of it. The flip side of that, I'll talk about how have organizations used it. I'll talk actually a little bit about my dissertation, if that's okay, because I think it's one of the areas where it kind of bridges all of these. 100%. And so there's a lot of data and research that shows, you tell me if you've seen this or heard this too, that buying teams are growing, that there's more functional diversity involved in those teams. So it's, where we were 10 years ago with maybe 5 people involved in a purchase decision, some of the latest data looks like there might be 12 or 15 or 20 people involved, whatever the number is, there's more people representing more functions within the organization. There's more executive involvement in the purchase decisions, and teams are really struggling to get alignment around making decisions at all. And even you put in the context that we've got more limited budget to go around, we're figuring out how to prioritize. The cost of cash is not the same as it was 3, 4, 5 years ago. The data is showing like more deals are lost to no decision now than ever before. That 40 to 60% of all sales deals are lost, right? Not to a competitor, but to nothing. So that's wasted time on the sales team and on the buyer side. So I was really intrigued by this. I'm going like, well, what does a salesperson do to overcome that? This great complexity in buying team behavior. Like, is it a sales skill? Is it a organizational design? Whatever it is. So I did a bunch of interviews with B2B salespeople, B2B buyers to say, what is it about salespeople that help create the alignment amongst that complex buying team? And what came out of it was this concept I call executive officer mentality. And the idea that the best salespeople to handle this complex buying team environment are salespeople who think like they're members of their customer's most senior executive team. They are aligning the value of their solution to the executive level priorities above the organization. They're building the point of value above any individual function. It's, if the CEO is saying in reporting to the street, we've got a 10% growth goal, how do my solutions help achieve that 10% growth goal? We're speaking in the language of our customer. There's great business acumen. There's industry acumen. We understand the priorities of the organization. We're contextualizing value at different levels, functional levels within inside of the organization. And so there, my guess is with your experience and those that have been in sales for a long time, you probably would go, well, of course, like I know salespeople to do that, or maybe even you do that or did that, right? Like that's not new. But have we had a way to define it? Have we had a way to measure it in an academically rigorous way? And then do we have a way to train against that and understand if it works? That's what my dissertation was about. So it's basically we studied 1,600 deals, the actual opportunity data across about a year and a half worth of a sales organization data. And no surprise, what we found in that is buying team complexity rose, like functional number of people involved, executive involvement, win rates dropped. No surprise there. But we also created a way to measure the extent to which a salesperson has this executive officer mentality. And it's not surprisingly, they're also able to mitigate and reverse that buying team complexity. They win far more often than those that don't have high levels of that executive officer mentality. So again, what this did, and I think even getting back to some of the things you initially talked about, was that it says this takes something that probably we all would in our gut would say makes sense. This is logical. But it takes it a step further and say, does it matter? Do we have a way to measure it? And do we have a way to train it and do something about that we can actually augment our teams? And so I'm working with a couple companies right now talking about how do we build executive officer mentality as a core organizational sales competency, basically, in their organization. Because we know if we can improve that your sales teams will win more. Mm-hmm. And so that's when you're thinking about where do I prioritize my budget? There's a million things I could invest in. I would argue that that's something, that development of that competency is going to improve win rates in a meaningful way. And we have a way to train against that. So yeah, that's just an example.
Yeah, it makes sense. It all makes sense. And you're correct. I mean, these are sort of somewhat intuitively obvious things that, you know, when you sell a lot, you sort of know you have to think like the buyer, and you have to think about the bigger problem that they're trying to solve and how you can kind of match your solution to that problem and all that stuff. But you're right. I mean, I think some of these things, they tend to be stuck inside the brain of like four or five people that just intuitively know this stuff, but it's not spread across the organization and trained. And then the other thing too is it's not built into some sort of codified competency assessment that you can determine how to hire people who are more likely to think that way earlier, so that you bring more people into the organization that bring that competency to the organization without having to train them to do it in the first place. I get it's great. So, you know, the other thing that's interesting to me while you're talking, and you mentioned that there is an encroaching way, and you probably know this a lot better than me, of how some of these platforms are being used to replicate these things. For example, I have a partner that I work with. I won't mention their name, doesn't matter. But they have a software platform that does a 2-year look back window on Salesforce data, but not just Salesforce data. It's also all the related data in the deal flow, emails, the Gong stuff, you know, everything that sort of surrounds the deals in their flow, right? And then it looks across all the deals that are happening and the ones that have happened, and it analyzes distinctions between deals that closed profitably, deals that closed and then renewed, and then deals that got lost and that just stalled. And what they're able to determine very effectively is to say, similarly, like you said, something like, okay, deals that fall into this category are the deals that we want. Not only did they close, but they were profitable, and they're also with clients whom are continuing to expand and grow. So then how do we identify ways to make more of those deals happen? One is the obvious, which is the ICP. Are they a certain type of customer? Fine. But the other part is, what are all the surrounding little pieces of stuff that we did around those deals that we did that we didn't think about happened? But they happen with enough consistency that if we are able to reconstruct that model, we likely have it happen more often. And then once we figure that out, we could test it and say, all right, let's assume that it's correct. Let's deploy a couple of salespeople and construct deals that way. And there are things like, how often do we speak to the client? What do we say to the client? Who from the client are we inviting into the deal? What are the titles of the people that we're bringing into the deal? What type of conversations are we having with the people that we invite into the deal? You know, all that stuff. Yeah. So what I'm saying is, like, what this stuff does is it ostensibly looks backwards, but it not only looks at just the clients and the ICP, but it looks at all the stuff that happened. It looks at, like, how many people did they speak to? Who did they speak to? What people and what seniority level did they bring into the deal? When did they bring them into the deal? How do they communicate with them? What was the way that they were able to talk to them? What was the cadence of communication? How often did they do it? What did they say? Also, how often did they find that the client responded, and how fast did they respond, right? All this stuff. And then they can build a model that says, all right, this is the way that we want to close a deal. And we think that there's an indication that if we can replicate these behaviors, it'll happen more often. And then let's say that works. Then the next part is, now we could take our B players and we could train them to do that and make them A players, because we don't know what we're training them against. We're sort of saying, just be a better salesperson. But now we're saying, here's the recipe. Learn this recipe and you'll be better. And it gives it much more easier way to measure what it is that you're implementing when you do a training program. Because right now it's very soft, skilly stuff, you know? And those are obviously important. I mean, you need that stuff. But I think that my opinion is the soft, skilly stuff is, that's innate. I mean, people are born with it. You know, you have musical talent. I have musical talent. I'm an artist. I have no idea why it is I was born with the ability to draw when I was like 3. Why is that? Who knows? I'm not going to try and figure that out. That's up to God and someone else. But I can. So, okay, great. So then that becomes some part of my competency that applies to different things. And like you know, you navigated your way and saw how your orchestral sort of brain was able to be utilized in different ways. Similarly with me, my creative brain can be used in a lot of different ways. But then it's also, where can I apply it? Like, what's the right way to apply that? You know, someone that it took me, I'm 60, it took me 60 years to figure out how to apply what it is that I'm good at. It took me literally probably 55 years before I was like, oh, wow, this is how I can wrap all this stuff into something, you know? So it sounds like if I'm maybe in a long, you know, way going around the block here, it may be the academia value proposition, in my view, is like, how do you kind of get there faster? Like, make it a little bit more surface this stuff quicker so you can do
I think so. And one piece of this that I had a unique viewpoint into over the last 15 to 20 years is, I think I led with this kind of the academic center for undergraduates that are actually training business to business sales professionals. And so even 15, 20 years ago, there was just a handful of schools that had programs the same way you'd earn a degree in marketing or a degree in finance or whatever it is to earn a degree in professional selling. And now there's, I think, somewhere close to 100 universities across the country that are training salespeople. So I agree with you that there are some skills that are just innate and some capabilities that are innate. But I've also seen that in programs that are intentional about how do you help students who are kind of developing into those roles, one, see the value of a sales career. I've used to have a hate relationship with sales. The unpredictability of my own income or the perception of the used car salesperson that's just pushing whatever it is I have to hawk on my customer.
There are plenty of those out there.
There are plenty of those out there, but gosh, I love sales because it really, those that do it well, and I feel like where it's trending is like, we're here to create value for other people. And I can benefit from that personally in a pretty impactful and significant way when I'm serving my customer well. And there's actually good research to support that too. But I, you know, you're helping expose the younger generation to the potential and the value of the sales function. And there's great universities that are training up these professionals in the mindset, in the skills, in the soft skills, but there's the hard skills, all the things that you're describing too, is that how do they set themselves up to hit the ground running when they roll into it. At one point in time, I heard, you know, 75% or something of marketing majors end up in sales roles, and the majority of those haven't had any background in sales at all. So you have a lot of people, some of the research I also do is on salesperson identification, which is really just how people identify with or don't identify with the sales profession. Like, yeah. is it part of who they are and how they think about their world, and they kind of reconcile that or step away from it. But I think a lot of people in sales have fallen into it in many ways. And now there's a much larger push towards people who are being exposed and see it as a really important and viable career path. And so, you know, there's great evidence that those that come out of these sales programs end up being top performers faster, that stick in the profession longer, that stay with their organizations, have higher earning potential, all those kinds of things. So,
yeah, I love it because I am a sort of like a crazy nutcase for sales and sales psychology and everything. I'm sort of a little bit of an obsessive about the whole thing. And it mainly because my brain is like that. I'm fascinated by people. I'm fascinated by what motivates people. I'm fascinated by what makes people make decisions. And I'm also fascinated about how often human beings, they lose in translation opportunities for connection and value because they don't know how to get a point across in a way that's persuasive enough that will make a difference. And in also many cases, what they're doing too, is they're being trained to persuade people for the wrong reasons. And so persuasion becomes something bad. And, you know, if you look at the sales industry, you know, it's one of the things that understandably, you know, a lot of, let's say, you know, parents would say, look, you know, go into sales, you know, because, you know, it's a way to make money and there's some degree of control of your destiny and there's so many sales jobs out there and you might as well go do it. Plus, it's a good skill because you learn how to talk to people, and there's absolute truth in all that. It's a very good thing to do. So, you know, having trained, I don't know, Christ, how many salespeople and managed how many salespeople in my career, I could see right away there's sort of a number of different buckets, but there's probably two larger like meta buckets, which are like the one is the person, sort of the opportunistic salesperson who got into this at a young age because it was just a thing that they chose to do. And they ended up engineering a career out of it because they realized that they had to, right? They sort of picked something that they weren't maybe innately good at, but they learned it enough that they got good at it. And you could tell there's a bit of it's a difference between someone who plays jazz and someone who plays, you know, fusion, you know? It's like the jazz player, doesn't matter where they are, they just pick up the guitar and they can figure it out. And then there's other people that sort of have to have some methodology that they learn because that's the way that they learned how to play, and you could hear it. And there's something less sexy about it, but it gets the job done, you know? And so it's like, okay. But then there's some people that just, they're like, wow, this person is sort of like a miracle worker. It's amazing. Like, no matter where you put this person, they can sort of figure things out. And the other weird thing about this is the opportunistic salespeople who can construct a career tend to be more successful because they know how to construct things and they can make it work. Whereas the natural flute player can just play the flute, but they'll play the flute in the subway. They don't care where they're playing and they can't make any money doing it, but they're like, I love playing the flute. I'll just play the flute. And you know, someone has to grab them and go, you idiot, I'm going to make you $1 million because you can play really well. Well, that's fine. I don't care where I play. I'm enjoying myself. And you know, that's the thing. It's like, how do you build a model where you get people whom have both? People who are just innately amazing at it, but know how to construct it in a way that makes it really useful. And I think that's where the organization comes in. So I want to talk about that a bit, right? The organization is like, you say commercial effectiveness, right? This is, I think, is a coordination of finding talent, putting it to talent into the work in the right way, in the right format, and knowing how to put the certain people in certain seats so they do things in a certain manner that gets the job done. I'd love to hear your thoughts on all this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So commercial effectiveness for sure is a huge part of the area that I think about, and I'm doing some research. And actually at Verisint, we released a market spotlight research study a couple months ago, and we surveyed over 1,400 sales and revenue leaders and found some really interesting things in that. And really this one piece of that was on this idea of commercial effectiveness. And in a lot of our interviews, a lot, what you described is right on, in the sense that like, how do you think about commercial effectiveness? The way I always thought about it is, It's the person themselves, like it's who we hire for, right? Like it's their abilities, the way they think, that kind of thing. Like we can hire for the profile. It's what they do. It's the actions, the behaviors they take. But there's this undervalued, and maybe for some, and maybe for others, it's not. But this undervalued, in the way I've seen it, the kind of sales ecosystem of sorts. And really, it's all of those things that sit within the organization itself. And we think about, and my experience has been that most companies treat this idea of commercial effectiveness, or whatever you would call it, as a training problem to solve for behaviors and actions in particular. And those, it's all well and good. Like those are good things. But the reality, I think there is exponential growth opportunity when you think of it more as a system design problem, for exactly what you were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. that we're thinking about the orchestration, not just of one individual salesperson, how I can make them 10% better, but how can I inject 10% better into our ecosystem so that it's exponentially impactful across all the people in our organization. Mm-hmm. And you can't fix structural misalignment with a training for soft skills or with a motivational speech or with a better incentive in general, but you can start to design different aspects of it and see them, some things that maybe we thought we've always done one way, and look at them in a more strategic way. And so one of these for sure is the idea of how we think about the design of our territories and how do we think about the design of our quotas. A lot of companies that I work with and I talk to, like, it's a very simple and very basic way that they look at it. We've got our ICP defined, we've got our TAM defined, all these sorts of things. It's like, great, we've got 50 salespeople, you each get 10 accounts and you each get $1 million of quota and go forth and conquer. But the reality is, even what you were describing earlier, there is so much better data that we have now than we ever have before that I think organizations aren't necessarily always taking advantage of, to say, well, we actually have some better information about the companies that we might assign to a territory, not to an individual, but to the territory itself, just to know, like, well, how might we predict their buying behavior? Are there intent signals? What all those kind of aspects of who in their organization do we have relationships with? What, the strength of those relationships, the executive strength of relationship. When are we bringing them into the into the conversation, or where are we at in a stage of a conversation with them? All of those kind of data points can help us get to a better understanding of the potential of an individual account and what we think might be there for us to uncover from a value perspective. And so the more advanced organizations are looking at commercial effectiveness and looking at some of these more micro process and going like, we actually need to think differently about the way that we design our territory. What is the market potential of this territory? And do we actually have a quota that's assigned to the value that we believe is in that territory? Or are we doing it in a more arbitrary way where we just kind of said, well, what do I think I can get this year? Or what did we do last year? Let's just bump it by 10% and go forth and conquer. And for some reps, they figure that out, right? And it's great. And maybe we land in the world of hitting our targets, right? But where I'm seeing more of a focus as we have more data and more tools to help us get more surgical with how we think about these things is there should be a great connection between those business processes, and we should be defining our territories much more strategically. So, you know, is there equity in between the territory and the quota itself as it's being designed? And so that's just one example, right? But it's really about thinking about, you can't coach or train your way out of a broken environment. But you can design the aspects of your business process more into connectivity and optimization that allow you to get more out of it. Again, it's that I'm not going to make my individual salesperson 10% better. That's a lot of effort. But can I make my organizational decisions 10% better so that everything kind of flows out of that's better? So that's just one example, but it's about thinking about the
bigger picture. All makes sense. I would assume that you would agree that like the RevOps organization is like the operational like lens through which all this stuff can happen, right? That's where the data takes place and stuff. So what is like how your relationship with a RevOps organization, how would a revenue operations organization utilize you to add whatever they're gleaning from the operational data that they're getting?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think RevOps is becoming the connective tissue of growth in an organization. And what might have been, I think part of our research too, again, this is no surprise to anybody, but there is a real cost to misalignment within your organization. We call it internal misalignment. 98% of revenue leaders or whatever it was in our study are like, yes, there is revenue that we are losing because we can't get our connections and value from our internal teams aligned. And RevOps, you know, that started as sales ops is now, you know, involving the RevOps simply because, and I think there's a very functional reason for it for sure. But I think even in name, the goal is to say like, we're trying to create alignment inside of our organization across functions. So where we might've just had these individual groups that were focused exclusively on sales or sales ops, and we might have had marketing ops, we might have had organizational biz ops or whatever it is, like revenue operations as a principle is designed to kind of create more connectivity between all of those functions in general. And so theoretically and practically, yes, that I think that is. And so but in practice, it's a little bit harder to do than it is just to talk about. Like a lot of the problems that we see with internal misalignment are organizational design problems because we have, you know, compensation that's being managed by HR, and we have RevOps that owns the territory design, and we have finance that owns the number and all these sorts of things. And it's like, yes, we find ways to kind of stitch it together with duct tape and bubble gum. But, you know, those are business processes that really are more need to be more connected organizationally than they are. So, you know, what I talk about, your question about, you know, what would I do and how would I work with RevOps in that way is to say, look, we can identify the problem and we can bring data to that problem so that when you can go back to your leadership and say, this is a problem that's worth solving. This is a problem that has revenue, meaningful revenue attached to it. And this is an area we should prioritize in the landscape of everything that we could do. This is one where we can see some opportunity gain. So it's a starting point for data to inform that. But then it's, what do we do? It more than likely, those individuals aren't going to have the ability to restructure the organization, in one fell swoop. But what I've started to see and started to propose in many ways is, how do you create better alignment amongst core business processes? And think about it from a systems perspective to say, how does our territory design process work? Who are the people that are involved in that? What are the dependencies that I need to be able to design a territory? Well, who requires the outputs from the territory to be designed? And none of this has to do with technology. Technology can certainly inform and support this, but even getting organizations just to slow down and start to get a little bit more surgical and precise about how they think about these individual processes inside of companies. And start to maybe even build, you know, ops teams that are kind of more focused on the business process than the function that they report to. that's where we're starting to see kind of this take place. And so in a lot, some of my earlier work in my world, in my business career, we would do customer journey mapping, right? Like where we're going, how does the customer walk through there's a buying process with us? And we get up where sticky notes and we're mapping the people, the process, the technologies and the places of friction and all these sorts of things. Well, I've just started applying that to the internal process as much as the customer buying process, right? Like, okay, so how does that thing happen? Let's map it. Let's talk about how these dependencies all work together. And so that's just one way. Is it the idea and the data that helps us realize there's something to change and helps us kind of get that internal momentum and start the conversation? Or is it with the tools and process to actually start to map out where there's friction and identify ways to kind of reduce that friction?
Gotcha. Thank you. So let's talk a bit about just briefly the CRO role itself. So I my business is totally focused on this. I don't know how much you've dug into what I'm up to, but you know, I just see the role as was always, in my opinion, it was always poorly defined, if not defined incorrectly. And I started the business to solve that, maybe basically because I think that it's not just the role, it's also the impact that it has on the business. And this alignment issue is one that I think is just became more pervasively a problem, and it for reasons that I think they're complicated. But the main thing I believe is ultimately the main thing, the main problem with businesses is the fact that it's comprised of people. And, you know, if people weren't involved, they'd probably run just fine. And yep, exactly. And so, you know, it really, we're the problem because we bring all sorts of mishigas and, you know, other things to the table that we just don't, many of us don't have much control over. And, you know, we are in a room together and we're trying to move things forward. And, you know, you add the multiple histories and, you know, psychosis of everybody in an organization, you know, you have a lot of problems. And so when you add more people to a leadership layer, you create another problem because you take the psychosis and the dysfunction and you put authority on top of that. And now you create silos that are just, they're impenetrable and it's a big problem. And so I think that, you know, the way that organizations were structured back in the maybe 70s, 80s, 90s were really this model of, like, you know, everyone gets a C-suite role. You know, there's this ascendancy. Everybody gets the C-suite title. And that's why people take these jobs, because they're going to get promoted and they're going to get that coveted C-suite position at some point, which I think they feel is, I don't know, represents something that we've created in the marketplace that people think it's important. And it is, I guess. And as a result of that perception, it is important because it does work from it opens doors and stuff and congratulations and plaques and money. But it doesn't do much for the customer. You know, the customer doesn't care about promotions. They just care about my product has to work. I just paid for something and I want it to work. And so, you know, if we are in these models, I think what I saw happening was you got the head of sales, the head of marketing, head of customer success, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you put them all in a room trying to make these very complicated decisions. It's impossible to make the decision. And then there's a compromise because we have to figure out, like, why Steve and Joe have to figure out a way to make their decision both happy. And so we meet in the middle. But meeting in the middle, it probably wasn't the best decision because the customer's not going to get the best decision. They're going to get one that made Steve and Bob happy, which is dumb. And so, you know, I think that the CRO role is intended to be a more encompassing role. It's the orchestrator. It's someone who knows how to conduct and understand systems and understands how things all fit together and coordinates and breaks those silos down so that the customer journey is really the map, right? Not the business, but the map is the customer. And it gets rid of those things. And the CRO role, I like to think, I say this too often, I maybe have influenced it to some degree, or I was there at the right time, that the role is evolving. And it's good. So that being said, it's a different role now, right? You're not hiring someone necessarily coming out of a head of sales role. You're probably looking more for someone who comes out of a head of RevOps role, because these are people who are probably more inclined to be better at the systems part. But the salespeople are the ones that are better at the leadership part and the communication part. And that's the interesting intersection between these really very complex skill stacks, which is someone who knows how to, like, stand up in front of a room, in front of a board, and persuade and put together a story and sell it and make it really clear and know how to respond and set the tone and be strong and, like, confident and build cohesion and that stuff. And then also know how to coordinate. And that's a pretty important person. It's not easy to find. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on where this is headed and how we structure revenue operations, not revenue, like revenue teams, I guess we'd say, or revenue systems from a leadership standpoint.
It's all a great question. I like that you called back to the 70s and 80s and 90s design, because I do think there's still carryover from
there
that,
is
right?
No like doubt it, there's muscle memory there, because we have a lot of old people like myself that still run these businesses, and that's how we were trained to do things, you know? So well, that's it, you know?
And while I think the utopian way that the chief revenue officer plays out to kind of align and connect those functions is the ideal. What you described is kind of, it's a career path. And a lot of companies, you know, create a CRO role because they're trying to elevate and give another stair step.
I will tell you stories that will spin your head as to why CROs are hired. It's crazy. I'm hearing
stuff
for the last 5 years.
I'll say simultaneously, it's got to be one of, if not the most high pressure jobs that there is, right? Yes. Like, and I think that contributes. I think there was some research by SBI recently that said like the average tenure of a CRO is like 18 to 24 months. Yeah. And you're like, I get it, or less than that, right? In many cases. So it's just the role is evolving, the pressure and the expectation. I think about the parallel of like an NFL head coach that's like, you know, you're expected to be hired and to win today. Like, you don't have time, which a lot of these things that we're talking about, like designing an organizational system and structure, take time. And it's like, and again, even the NFL or football parallels, it's like, do you have time to build your recruiting arm? Do you have time to build your strength and training and development arm? Do you have time to build, instill your offense and all these kinds of things? Like, no, you've got to figure out how to win now with the resources you've got, while simultaneously figuring out how to plug the gaps over the next 6 to 12 months, or you're out of job. So, I think it's probably one of the most complicated areas to approach. So I don't ever want to make it sound simplistic by any means, but I do think a couple things that you've touched on are really important in terms of the orchestration piece, is that the CRO role is evolving from being a master forecaster to master orchestrator. And I think it is this combination, part psychologist, part data strategist, part systems architect as well inside the organization, all with some great leadership capabilities and communication and persuasion capabilities on top of all that. And so when you think about the orchestration of systems and the people that you have, the data that you have, the incentives that you use, which I also believe that incentives are probably one of the most overused but underemphasized tools that we have to manage behavior inside our organization. They are the signal that show what we value, mm-hmm. that we don't really spend the right time thinking about. But they're the ones that have to orchestrate the strategy around that, right? And so I think the CRO, the evolution of that, the CRO of the future looks like the systems architect that's thinking about the connection between the strategy, the analytics, the organizational identity. Like, they also have to understand behavioral science as deeply as they understand finance. Like, they have to have emotional intelligence.
Really strange person.
Where do you find that?
Where do you find that? It's true. I know. Here's what I think happens, and I have this happen a lot. Is like the way I've sort of navigated this, and this is the problem is interesting, Curtis, because if I'm aware of that, let's say I'm a CEO founder, and I'm aware of this, I have the knowledge that you and I are talking about. I know that I need this person to do these things, then what's going to happen is I'm going to be in an endless search for this unicorn that doesn't exist, and I'm never going to hire anybody. So the question is then, okay, this is fascinating. What's the compromise? Like, what's the right one to hire for? And, you know, then the other side of it is someone who takes the job is also up to the same problem. It's like, I can't do all this stuff. And it's not what people think. I just want to say, I hear this a lot. People say, well, you're never going to find anybody that's good at marketing and good at sales and good at customer success. I mean, that's not the problem. That's actually easy to solve. I can just hire those people that are good at that stuff. It's all the other things. It's understanding systems and understanding like process, understanding people. Like, it's the stuff you and I are talking about that people don't really understand. So there's that. So what I do is the solution is a different approach, which is you want to find someone whom has, I would say, the core, let's say, you know, minimum value competencies, and also has at least one of those that they are a like savant at. So let's say I find someone whom I think while all these orchestration skills and everything are vital for the job, the thing that you have to have is you have to have incredible communication skills and confidence in yourself, because you're dealing with so many different types of people in your job that you need to know how to navigate that. And if you don't, you're going to get eaten alive. And so if you have that, and then one of the other ones. Let's say, for example, I'm really a great leader, and you know this person just has a certain gravitas and command and real good background. And, you know, you can put it in front of people and they'll be able to handle themselves. But they don't have strong financial skills, but they are unbelievably good at knowing how to create value and understand how to develop customer relationships and stuff, and they can build teams and hire people and stuff. Okay, hire that person, but then find them a finance person that'll work with them to compensate for that. Don't say, I'm not hiring that person because of that, because you're missing out on the way that you construct the system to support that person. Alternatively, if it's someone who's an amazingly smart person with making financial models and has those leadership skills, then find somebody who understands the other side of it to support them. You're never going to find the perfect person. You have to build the organization that takes that great person and makes them shine, because waiting for that perfect person never, ever happens. And I see this happen a lot where there isn't a – this would be an interesting thing for you to do, if you don't mind. Some research on this.
A research question? Exactly. Of course. I love
how does a how does a knowing the competency stack of a chief revenue officer, how do organizations best design their hiring practices to bring aboard one in the manner that we said, like to what we're talking about? I'm sure there's some way that it could be codified, so that the problem I'm seeing is CROs or get hired incorrectly and they don't last and it's not their fault, or the company doesn't know what they're hiring for and so they don't last and it's not their fault. There needs to be more data, which I'm attempting to do, so that this marriage, it's a marriage, by the way, is better. And I think it'd be cool to put a academic lens on this, because there is one available. I don't have the ability to do it. So anyway, we can talk about some other time.
I love it. It sounds like the perfect partnership with the CRO Collective, that we could do a big research project.
I think it'd be great.
I think there's a book here, Warren.
I wrote one and it's coming out in a month, and it's called What CROs Actually Do. And that's coming out in a month. And it's stuff like this, but I, of course, didn't do any research into what we're talking about. It's another one is like how to make the CRO marriage work or something like that. But anyway, I think it's a fascinating thing. And what you said is right. And that is that this role is evolving in ways that are faster than organizations know how to keep pace with. And without that right modality, they're not going to do it right. They're going to continue to try and use old models to hire people, and they're going to keep making the mistake. And other people who want the job are going to be interviewing like the old model, and they're going to make that mistake. And I'm working on both sides in my business, but you know, there needs to be more noise, in my opinion, about this.
That's right. That's right. And that's where good research and good data can help, because it's the tip of the spear of what conversations should we be having for those teams that are hiring, those executive teams that are hiring. What capabilities should we be looking at? Are we looking at the old models? Or are we looking for what we need now and the complementary skills that we need at the executive level to be able for that role to be successful? So I think it's a beautiful way to approach it.
Well, cool. Look, we're hit our time here, but I know you and I, I'm sure, could talk for 7 more hours. And I'll follow up with you. I think we should talk more. But what's up? Like, what's next for you? And what do you want people to know? And what are you trying to get done that, you know, you want to communicate to the listeners right now?
Well, there are a couple things. And if I can, on a couple different angles, there's one, of course, is I think the gap that we have to fill our headspace and our thinking with really good ideas and really credible ideas is we need data to do that. We need companies to partner with to be able to understand these problems. So for anybody that's listening that sees value in these ideas and wants to explore it, the way we explore it is by actually looking at what's happened and what's happening, and we need data. So but that would be the big piece. Is there are people that want to partner, there are companies that want to partner. That's not necessarily a financial commitment. That is a data commitment, which has its own cost to it for sure. But it's a that's something that can help us get more clarity, both into your individual organization and what's happening more broadly. That's one. I'll also say, you know, as a secondary piece of this for anybody that's listening, one of the things that have brought me the most joy and satisfaction in my role is to look at how The skills and abilities that we have that we apply in the for-profit sector also have great translation into the nonprofit sector and how we can help more from a societal perspective. And there's some work that I've done in particular with an organization called the Prison Entrepreneurship Program that we took some of the ROI models, the same business value assessment kind of capabilities that we would use to help an organization make a purchasing decision and say, how do we help quantify the value of this social program that helps incarcerated men and women enter society more successfully? And is there an economic value to having people productive in society? And is it reduce the recidivism rate, the time that they go back to jail, the amount of time that they go back to jail, all these kinds of things? And so the second part being, I think it's important to think about societally, how do we use our skills and abilities to help even be beyond our normal areas of influence? There's plenty of ways to do that. And I think there's some cool ways that we can do that through research. And just, I think anybody can do that with the skills and the abilities that they have. But really, I think that the closing thoughts that I have on this, of course, are just that, you know, whether you're in a corporate revenue system, whether you're in a human transformation program, wherever you find yourself, the pattern is the same. When you create alignment inside your organization, it creates growth. And when you have data and design and purpose, when all those things are connected, you help your people flourish. So for the CROs, for the heads of sales, and even for the salespeople that might be listening to this, it's like, bring all those, your best to the human systems that we all get to be a part of. When we can combine behavioral science and data and our skills and our ability, we can build organizations that perform well, but then uplift everybody around us. And so I hope we start to see our work as connecting, and I see this in my world, but it's connecting science and service through sales and translating the insights that we have and the skills we have into real impact for our companies, for our customers, and ultimately for society.
Great. I love it. It's a great mission, noble mission. And I'm with you. Okay, great. Well, look, thank you so much. This is an amazing conversation. And again, I want to thank the Revenue Alliance for this partnership. The next CRO Summit, the Revenue Alliance CRO Summit, is happening in Chicago on the 18th of November. And I'll be there chairing the event. So please come. And thanks again. And we'll see you next time.